1988, our second session, we're sitting in the apartment of Alex Lowenthal in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, since our last visit, Mr. Lowenthal has lost his wife, Anne, of how many years?
54 years.
Of 54 years. We're so glad to be back with you now to continue our talks. Last time we were talking of some of the very interesting anecdotes of Eleanor Roosevelt, and we would like to continue today of some of your perceptions and thoughts concerning Mrs. Roosevelt and then, of course, the President.
In the first place, I'd like to add that Mrs. Lowenthal and I formed a sort of a combination pair. Our thinking was so congenial on so many subjects, whether the subjects dealt with American political life, the needs of humanity, international affairs, art, Jewish problems, and so on, that I've just looked over many of the letters that came either to me or to Mrs. Lowenthal, and in the letters, invariably, if Mrs. Lowenthal is being thanked for something or commended about something, they'll always mention the fact that I was with her or that I'm on the same subject and so on. And the same way with the letters that I received, invariably there was something mentioned about Mrs. Lowenthal. And so, speaking about the Roosevelts, I'd like to say this. In the first place, in 1932, at the convention, at the Democratic political convention in Chicago, that nominated Franklin Roosevelt for the presidency, I was there. And I sat in a box with Haywood Broome. And very much, Haywood Broome was very much opposed to Roosevelt as governor, who had been governor of New York. And the day before the nomination, Haywood Broome issued a circular, which he circulated to all the delegates, entitled Franklin Roosevelt, the Corkscrew Politician. Needless to say, immediately thereafter, Roosevelt was nominated. But I had long talks with Haywood Broome, whom I had known a little bit from years before, whom I had read constantly in the, when he wrote for the, I think it was the New York Herald Tribune.
Why was he so opposed to him?
Because he thought some of the laws that Roosevelt advocated as governor of New York, really were more vote-getting laws than they were aiding humanity. They sounded as if they aided humanity, but they were invariably politically motivated, his actions were. Roosevelt was a political animal, and he had many wonderful ideas for aiding those who needed it, whether it was by way of health, housing, education, advancement, training, and so on and so forth. It was through my friendship with Leon Kaiserling, who in the first Roosevelt years was a secretary to Senator Wagner of New York and helped write the Wagner Labor Relations Act. But in the Roosevelt administration, Leon Kaiserling had a major hand in every New Deal enactment that are so highly regarded today, and helped not only re-elect him, but helped change the political climate from those who have to the have-nots. In my conversations with Leon Kaiserling, who was a professor of economics and a graduate of Harvard Law School, and I was a graduate of the Yale Law School, we had very much in common, but particularly we had in common in solving the problems of a nation, you should start at the bottom and move up instead of starting at the top and dripping down. This was true of my thinking all my life, and it was true of Leon Kaiserling's thinking, it was true of Eleanor Roosevelt's thinking, but it wasn't necessarily true of Franklin Roosevelt's thinking. Franklin Roosevelt, as a political animal, as a political human being, position, how many more votes does one bring, does a certain action bring him as against the fall off as a result of his actions? Because of my connection with Leon Coyote, I became very friendly with a kitchen cabinet of Roosevelt's that consisted of Ben Cohn, Tommy Corcoran, Tugwell, Judge, I can't think of his name, who wrote all Roosevelt's speeches. He was a member of the Manji's firm in New York, and I was a very close friend of Horace Manji's, because Horace Manji's, who was a leading partner in that firm, was at Columbia while I was at Yale. And it was with Horace Manji's that I helped bring to Yale two Jewish institutions of which I am very proud. One was I brought the first menorah society to Yale, and secondly, I brought the Pi Lambda Phi fraternity to Yale. Yale had quotas all through the years, and Jews were not admitted ordinarily to Greek letter societies and so on. And I was instrumental in bringing both these efforts, and I worked with Horace Manji's during those years.
We're going to go back to Yale a little bit later because we want to hear more of that period of your life. But since this is an interview also with the Council of Jewish Women, we would like to hear more about the input or the feelings of Roosevelt and the Jews. Well, years later, we're hearing many more things about
There is no question that Roosevelt was 100% for the Jews, and he was very much influenced all his life by Henry Morgenthau, who had been his neighbor for many, many years at their estates, and who became the Secretary of Treasury and was the Secretary of Treasury during the entire Roosevelt period. I must say this for Henry Morgenthau. Henry Morgenthau was a much more intense Jew than people give him credit for, because Henry Morgenthau was not an articulate leader. Henry Morgenthau was a doer, and he had been trained by his father, who was the first American ambassador to Turkey during the era, during the era when the Sultan of Turkey had what is now called Palestine. It was then called Southern Syria prior to World War I. And Henry Morgenthau's father was very instrumental in changing the American political attitude vis-a-vis what later evolved into the Balfour Declaration and so on and so forth. And it was, although many times people like Rabbi Stephen Wise or Rabbi Hillel Silver thought they were inside men vis-a-vis the president, it is my opinion that Henry Morgenthau had the inside track at all times. Although Stephen Wise used to think of he was the Jewish prince at court in Washington, and he did go there and he did have access to Roosevelt. But at the same time, I believe that Henry Morgenthau was much more persuasive and influential.
Excuse me, what do you mean when you say Roosevelt was 100% for the Jews? What did he, how did it manifest itself?
Well, it manifests itself with reference to any kind of legislation dealing with immigration or any other problems, and particularly with the evolution from the Balfour Declaration of 1917 to the time the state was created in 1947. It's a very long period. He died in 45, but during that entire period, there were very, very minuscule steps, because the British government, after issuing the Balfour Declaration, tried over and over again to reduce its impact and reduce its meaning and so on. It's very interesting to know also that though Chaim Weizmann had a tremendous impact on Lord Balfour, who was a British Foreign Secretary in World War I, Lord Balfour himself could not persuade the British to go out for the creation of a Jewish homeland. I want to call your attention to the fact that in the Balfour Declaration, all it mentions is the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people, and with conditions that no Arab institutions be affected by it. And Morgenthau's father had a great deal to do with the political evolution of the whole idea of the development of a homeland into more than just a homeland, and develop something that's much more like a state.
Excuse me, Alex. You talked about the Balfour Declaration as
The Balfour Declaration, yeah.
As a statement just for the Israelis, for Israel. What do they mean when you said that the Palestine had nothing to do with Palestine? With
what
the
do
Arabs?
You mean what?
You said it did not affect the Arabs.
No.
How could you do something?
The reason, in my opinion, the main reason why the British issued the Balfour Declaration was that there were, in World War I, there were an awful lot of German Jews in America who had considerable political power and who were a little bit not too antagonistic to the Kaiser. And in order to counterbalance this feeling in the world, the British were willing to have Lord Balfour write this letter to Lord Rothschild. The Balfour Declaration was only a letter from the British Foreign Secretary to Lord Rothschild. But after World War I, little by little, the Balfour Declaration was incorporated into all the post-war treaties. And from then on, the Jews of the world sought to convert the homeland idea contained in the Balfour Declaration to a state. However, this was not new to Jewish thinking, because already in 1882 and 83, after the assassination of Tsar Alexander II, the drive of Jews throughout the world was actually to colonize what is now Palestine. Up until that time, Jews went to Jerusalem and the area around Jerusalem to study or to die, but never to actually go into the process of creating colonies. And it was in 1882 when the Bilu was established that they decided actually to create a colony. Then after the Dreyfus case, when Herzl involved, they decided to start the real political work on a worldwide basis, as well as the economic work on a worldwide basis, to carry out the movement from colonies into a state.
When you talked about President Roosevelt and you said that he was supportive of the Jews, you said he helped to get better immigration policies. Where? In which country?
In the United States.
I was not aware of that. I thought the laws were very much the same based on the proportion of people that came from certain countries in years past.
In the first place, in the period between, shall I say, the Balfour Declaration and the end of the Roosevelt period, that was the whole World War I and World War II, practically World War II period. Up until the time of the actual Nazi, Hitler period, Roosevelt was quite helpful in seeing to it that the immigration laws were not too strictly carried out. However, now wait, I wouldn't change. I wouldn't withdraw that remark, because later on, after starting about 1926 or 27, and going through them and through the Roosevelt periods, Jewish immigration was fairly restricted insofar as that the immigration laws were very strictly carried out.
Yes, I thought so. What, is that the McCarran-Walter Act?
That comes even later.
Okay.
McCarran-Walter Act, honestly. But it was during the Hitler period when the Jews really wanted to get out of Germany, that Roosevelt clamped down on the immigration laws and didn't allow the Jews to come in. And that's why you have the history of St. Louis and the history of all the boats that tried to come in, and the Jews were not admitted.
Why do you think he reacted that way, by not letting them in?
He always said that in any matter that had to do with Hitler and the war, he followed Churchill. And the Churchill himself thought that the winning of the war was the first thing on the agenda, and that to win the war was most important. Therefore, everything else had to be put aside or cut down until we first hit Hitler.
Could he have been more effective in trying to save some of the Jews in a quieter way if he wanted to?
My personal opinion is that he couldn't have. The State Department itself in the United States was very much opposed to furthering the immigration of Jews in America at the time. And Roosevelt was the kind of a political person who followed all those appointees like Sumner Wells and Secretary of State Hull and so on and so forth. And it was their opinion at the time to cut down so as to concentrate the effort on winning the war.
So that he wasn't really against the Jews so much as he was prioritizing.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Do you think the criticism of him in later years for not helping enough in this area of trying to save more Jews was...
I don't understand the
Do you think that was unfair, the later criticism?
Yes, I do, because I don't think that could in any way have affected the outcome of the war.
It might not have affected the outcome of the war, but it might have saved thousands and thousands or millions.
But of course, saved the Jews.
Yes.
And it wouldn't have affected the outcome of the war. It would have been,
oh.
Ultimately, the Allies would have won the war.
But during the war, you had no knowledge of...
During the war, the whole emphasis... I have no particular knowledge about Jews. The whole emphasis was to win the war.
Mm-hmm.
Win the war. I would also like to add this one point in here, because it isn't very generally known, that one of the major things in winding up World War II was the so-called Manhattan Project. Okay. And the Manhattan Project is the project of Otto Szilard, a Hungarian Jew. It was Otto Szilard who told the president what the Germans are doing vis-a-vis nuclear evolution, and he was the one who persuaded Roosevelt to engage in the Manhattan Project. Szilard's cousin, whose name was Ladislav Sego. I think their names in Hungary were Seal. There were three brothers or something like that. And each one had a name that sounded like Seagull. Would have been changed a little bit and so on. But Lotzi Sego, who was one of the greatest city planners in the world, who came to Cincinnati about 1921 or 22 or 23, was one of my closest friends. And as a matter of fact, his widow, who's Velma, just set up at the Montefiore Hospital, something special in my wife's name. As a matter of fact, I'm just getting the check right now. She just told me I was Cincinnati.
Did you have any knowledge of the Holocaust during the war?
Yes. We had That's a very interesting question. Let me tell you, when we first got our knowledge, I was on a small committee. At that time, I think I was the national chairman of speakers for the before the United Jewish Appeal, United Israel Appeal, I mean, or United Palestine Appeal. And we were called together. When I say we, it was Rabbi Wise and Rabbi, he's the rabbi of Cincinnati. His father was a rabbi in New Orleans. Heller, Rabbi Jimmy Heller. We're called together at a meeting at the Biltmore Hotel in, I think, around March of 1942. In March of 1942, a shaliach of the Orthodox Jewish community in Europe brought us word that Auschwitz, which was a concentration camp, had been converted into a death camp. Rabbi Wise immediately...
What year was this?
1942. Spring of 1942.
Spring.
I think it was February of 1942 or March 42. We didn't believe it. We knew there were concentration camps all over, but they were all labeled as work camps, in which Hitler said to put them there because we need all kinds of ammunition, special work, and so on and so forth. But the shaliach informed us that Auschwitz then became Auschwitz, and it became, instead of a concentration camp, it became a death camp. And they built these furnaces and these gas chambers and so on to destroy the Jews. Rabbi Wise immediately went to Washington to find out about this, and they dealt with Sumner Wells, and Sumner Wells, he came and reported back. He said that Sumner Wells
at that time was
a deputy, he was the Undersecretary of State. And he said there was absolutely, he had no knowledge of it whatsoever. Since he came back with that report, the Jewish community of America had the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, which they had established around 1907, 1906, or something like that, with their offices in Geneva. And so we asked our administrator in Geneva to try to get to Poland, to Auschwitz, to see if it's true. About 2 or 3 months later, he came back and he says, it is true. It has been converted into a death camp. And the one thing we were never able to do, with all our persuasion, because immediately set up 8 or 9 of these death camps, and we were never able to get Roosevelt to persuade Churchill and the American Army to bomb any of the death camps. Never in the whole war.
Why?
We don't know that. Churchill felt that he couldn't spare the bombers and so on and so forth. They certainly could have, and that's one of the things we hold against them all the time.
Why would you want them to bomb the death camps?
So
there were Jews in there.
No, but to destroy the camps.
The mechanical setups.
I know, but there were Jews at the time.
When I said destroy the camps, destroy the machinery for the Jews, just these big rooms they had where they poured this chemical in, you know, and so on, and where they burned the bodies and stuff like that. See? They wanted to destroy the machinery for it.
Virtue of being a Monday morning quarterback, in retrospect, were there some people or some avenues or another road that might have been taken to be more influential in that respect?
Yeah, war was going on, and the only way you could do it is by carrying out a military action, and the only way you could do that was through the president, and the president invariably blamed it on Churchill.
Did you work with the Jewish community in England
I didn't do that.
Is there anybody that tried to?
I'm quite sure it must have been, but I didn't know it. I wasn't involved. for that in England at that time.
So what you're also saying is you are sure, in fact, that our administration knew about it in 1942?
No, I would say that maybe in 1943 they became aware of it. Mm-hmm. But they knew about it from then on, yes. Mm-hmm. They knew about it.
It's interesting that your daughter has carried on the importance of studying and learning about the Holocaust.
Well, it's very interesting the way that all comes about. My daughter is a professor of history at San Francisco State University. That's one of the California State Universities. Also a scholar in residence at Stanford. She's a historian by profession. And very much interested, of course, in things Jewish. Many years ago, when about the only humane thing that we knew about the Holocaust period came from the story of Anne Frank, who was a little girl, age 12 or 13 years old, holed up in a little house in Amsterdam between two walls, and just writing her diary. My daughter came across another story, which she thinks is a much more descriptive story of the entire Holocaust, with reference to an entirely different person. And this person's name is Charlotta Salomon, S-A-L-O-M-O-N. Charlotta Salomon, during the Hitler period, particularly in 1938, was a star student of art and an artist at the Bauhaus. Her father was a very, very leading surgeon in Berlin, and they were members of the general social group in Berlin. They never thought that Hitler would ever get them. But in 1938, Hitler did get them and swept through it, and Charlotte was immediately discharged from the Bauhaus in Munich. And she and her father and her mother were compelled to flee from Berlin. Her mother died soon after en route out of Berlin, and the father and the daughter traveled the usual route for all of the uprooted German Jews, first to Amsterdam, then to Copenhagen, and then to Vichy, and then from Vichy down to Nice, till Hitler broke with Mussolini, and then from Nice to a town called Gour on the Franco-Spanish border, which was sort of the last exit the Jews could find to get out of this thing. At Gour, Hitler's deputy, who was in charge of the so-called solution of the Jewish problem, caught up with them and sent the daughter, Charlotte, and her father to Auschwitz, where they were destroyed. This is a period of about 5 years. Charlotte, being an artist, Charlotte drew, did watercolors, pastel, and so on, some 1,200 or 1,300 of them during this period, indicating reactions to all the events of the fleeing Jews. How Charlotte got these drawings and so on to her stepmother. Her father remarried after her mother died. Married to her stepmother, who had fled from Nice into the Italian section when Hitler broke with Mussolini. Then Mussolini was put out and so on and so forth. very funny thing with her. I got the letter today. What's your letter to Paula, daughter Mary?
Again, say it.
Dated July the 7th, 1988, from Amsterdam. Thanks so much for your letter to Paula's house. It was good to hear from you. I'm here with Paula now, and she sends her best wishes to you as a fellow 90-year-old.
What's Paula's last name? Salomon.
Salomon, yes. 9 years old. Tomorrow I fly to London for the next part of our trip. Amsterdam was, listen, this was very intense. I spent hours today talking with the curator of the Stedelijk Museum, Ed Peterson. And the reason for that is part of the Stedelijk Museum of during this period of 5 years of flight, which are, she did 1,300 drawings and caricatures and cartoons and things like that. See, yeah, but
that's her stepdaughter.
And Mary is just with him, a brilliant and charming man. I look forward to seeing this. But anyway, now I want to tell the story about Charlotte and so on.